Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. My name is Karen Karp and I am filling in for Mitchell Davis this morning. I am very happy to welcome Jane Black as my guest today on the Taste Matters show. Jane Black is a Brooklyn-based food writer, formerly and sometimes currently still writing with the Washington Post, who is currently writing a book about Huntington, West Virginia, possibly most well-known as the sight test for Jamie Oliver's food revolution in school foods. And Jane and her husband are currently writing a book about what happened in Huntington, West Virginia after the Jamie Oliver effect and the effort to create healthy food cultures in small cities around the country. I invited Jane to speak with us today on the show because she and I, from very different perspectives and with very different skills and sometimes similar approaches, are both working on significant issues to improve the food culture, food society, food economy, the way food works in different places around the country, particularly as we are thinking about anti-obesity strategies and increased food access. And for purposes of this show, we're going to talk significantly about how taste is an important ingredient in food system change. Jane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So remind me how we first connected.
Well, I write so I was a staff writer at the Washington Post, and now, as I always joke, I'm a freelance writer, and I write for The Times and The Atlantic and, you know, anybody really who will pay me. I'll just put a little ad there for myself. No, but seriously, I write a column called Smarter Food, and the goal of the column once a month that runs in the Washington Post food section is to talk about, you know, ways that ideas, people, concepts that are really helping to scale good food and sustainable food. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so often what we read about are these wonderful personalities, the small farmer with an acre of tomatoes, or, you know, the guy with the little restaurant with 10 tables. And, you know, that's fabulous. But, you know, how is that bringing in a larger group of people? Mm-hmm. How is it changing the way food works? And so I got in touch with you when I was writing about the New York City Green Cart program.
Oh, right. That's right.
Which I think we can talk about later. Yeah. But, you know, what's interesting is that I often write a lot about economics. I write about psychology. I write about, you know, incentive programs. And I find myself that taste doesn't come up as often as it should. And when you talk to people about why they eat what they eat because they like it. And so I think increasingly, you know, this idea is important, and I'm looking for stories where people are working on changing the way people think about taste and flavor.
Right, exactly. So it's a very important part of our work as well, and we at Carp Resources are always working on the largest possible system we can find that will engage us to help them shift something about the quality of food within a large system. And we've done an awful lot of work with New York City schools on this issue, particularly around local procurement, where it turned out, to everybody's great surprise, and I think it was a thing that really helped the local procurement effort go forward with New York City schools, is when we were able to find and procure local peaches, which was exactly 4 years ago this month, from New Jersey, rather than peaches they had been purchasing from South Carolina, lo and behold, the flavor of them was way better, because not because they were local per se, but because for peaches, like many other products, the longer you transport them, the less ripe they have to be when they're picked. So all of a sudden, New York City school kids were getting ripe peaches and ripe nectarines at the right price, and they were loving them and consuming more of them. So this was a, you know, not something that was formally evaluated, but observationally evaluated. Yeah, these kids are eating more of these because they're juicier, they taste better, et cetera. So when you came to New York, when you came to visit the Green Cart Initiative, what if anything connected to taste did you observe?
Well, you know, in the book, just to step back for a second, you know, we're writing about Huntington, West Virginia, and this is a place where, you know, you think, because it's the, one of the most unhealthy cities in America, that it's going to be a food desert, because that's what you hear. You hear, you know, people just don't have access to healthy food. But in fact, you know, there are plenty of grocery stores, and I lived there for 6 months and managed to eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and organic and all this stuff. But the issue was that when I would go to the supermarket and I would check out with all my fruits and vegetables, the people in front of me and behind me were buying frozen pizzas and, you know, Hamburger Helper. And I always used to laugh. I would say, you know, they look like they're checking out of Toys R Us. They're all these big, colorful boxes with cartoon characters, and I have broccoli. Uh-huh. And so that really sort of really made me stop and think a lot about, you know, is it a question of, is it always a question of access, or is it a question of values and desire? Mm-hmm. And the Green Card program, what I think is so interesting about it is that, you know, it works on food access, which is a very fashionable concept right now, but it does it in a place where the people really want it. Mm-hmm. They're not just saying, we're going to drop a giant Walmart in here because there aren't enough grocery stores per square mile per number of people. Mm-hmm. You've got these immigrant communities in New York who come from other countries where they're used to having access to fresh fruits and vegetables all the time, and suddenly they get to New York and they can't find them, and they can't understand why.
Right.
And here's this really low-cost solution that creates jobs and has a whole, you know, number of ancillary benefits, but essentially puts good food in a place where people already want it at a price they can afford.
Right.
And that's what, you know, the reason that I wanted to write about it for Smarter Food, because it isn't just something that fits the fashionable notion of we have to help low-income people have better food.
Right.
It gives it to people who want it.
Right. The thing that has that's attracted me to working with the initiative, which we've now been doing for 3.5 years, was, you know, again, like you, like not exclusively or expressly for the sort of big picture thing if we want to increase food access, but the fact that Green Cards uses entrepreneurship as a mechanism to test demand and using social enterprise to shift that part of the system to test the availability and the viability of selling fruits and vegetables. And so, you know, our measure of success is if these vendors can make a living doing it, then that means that more people are eating fresh fruits and vegetables. And we do a lot of work with the vendors to make sure that they're buying as high quality product as they possibly can, because we know they have to sell it at a low cost and there's perishability issues, et cetera. It's a constant kind of balance of all these issues. And they're, you know, I think after a few years that they've been doing it, they're getting a little bit more of a sort of a steady beat. But something somebody brought to my attention, actually the co-author of a report, and I can't remember who it is at the moment, but two researchers at Columbia University just published a paper about what the immigrant piece of food access. So New York City, as and we're going to talk about other cities around the country, because Huntington is not New York City, and so is many of the other places where we're working on these issues. But this research focused particularly on New York City immigrants and the where food access initiatives touch or don't touch New York City immigrants. And the very interesting thing that they found is that pretty much across the board, new immigrants to New York City are almost fearful of supermarkets, not because they think they're dangerous, they're just foreign, a little bit to your point earlier on. So people coming to the United States for the first time who have access to fruits and vegetables on the street through street vending in different places around the country, they come to New York City and lo and behold, all the efforts to help them eat better is in a paradigm that is unfamiliar and untrustworthy by them. And so we're inviting them to spend a little bit of time this summer with Green Card vendors to kind of do some intercept interviews with some of the customers. And we hope to actually be able to present this to the city to discuss these other kinds of methods for improving food access, since most of the increased population we're going to have here in the next 15 years are going to be immigrants. So, but let's go back to Huntington, West Virginia, and the culture there and the people there. I'm thinking about you, imagining you on this supermarket line with your broccoli, surrounded by lots of people who are probably weigh a whole lot more than you with non-broccoli. I'm actually really curious, what did that broccoli taste like when you got it home? What did you do with it and how did it taste?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's interesting. When I have lived in bigger cities, I know I have been a regular farmer's market attendee and, you know, have put an emphasis on local. And because I couldn't get anything local, in addition to living there, we were living there in the middle of winter. So there was absolutely
double whammy.
Yeah. And so we made a decision that we were going to buy as much organic produce as we could, partially because, you know, we wanted to see how much it would cost us to eat sort of the best mm-hmm. that we could get over mm-hmm. the course of the winter. So, you know, I mean, broccoli in the middle of winter tastes sort of like broccoli in the middle of winter. I mean, mm-hmm. it was pretty good. I mean, we are good cooks, so we were able to turn a lot of vegetables for not a lot of money into some pretty good stuff. You know, we would make soups, we would braise meats, we would, you know, and the other interesting thing about Huntington is, and I confess, I say this all the time just to admit that I am or was, you know, kind of, I don't know if I would call it a food snob, but misled about what it would be like. You know, you watched this place on TV and you thought, where am I going?
Right.
You know, and the supermarket there is just like the supermarket here. Uh-huh. I mean, you can get soy sauce, you can get fish sauce, uh-huh. you can get all of, you know, chili sauce, all these things. So we were really able to make just about anything that we wanted to make. The things that we were missing were kind of sustainable meats, which we drove to Columbus, Ohio to get.
Okay.
and
thank you, Columbus, Ohio.
Yes. And really good cheese that we ordered on the internet. But other than that, you know, we were really able to do very well. And that, I think, was a big revelation to me, because you think there must be a reason that this city has these health problems. Mm-hmm. So they must not get the food. Mm-hmm. But they do have the food. Mm-hmm. It's just, coming back to the taste thing, what they choose to do with it. Why isn't that what they want to eat? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it comes back to, you know, this whole concept of American food culture, which is, you know, we have been told for 50 years that it should be fast mm-hmm. and that it should be easy mm-hmm. and that...
It should be abundant.
And it should be abundant. And it should be cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Fast, easy, cheap, and abundant doesn't equal going home and making soup out of fresh vegetables. You know, even if they wanted to, it's not what their friends do. It's not what they've been taught to do. And particularly in a place like this, my husband actually wrote an amazing article, if I do say so myself, for Lapham's Quarterly's food issue, which is about nostalgia. So, you know, here in Brooklyn... You know, the idea of going back to the land, of being a farmer, it's so cool and feels so different. In Huntington, West Virginia, the idea of going back to the land and being a farmer sounds like poor.
Right. Absolutely.
It sounds like hardship. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds like hunger.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that. Right. They want cool and modern is going in and picking something up out of the frozen, you know,
Absolutely.
Case and microwaving
right.
it. And so that, so changing that value and is important, and I believe that changing that value comes through taste.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to persuade them to do it by telling them it's good for them,
right?
Or by being an English celebrity chef and parachuting in with cameras
and criticizing the USDA.
Right.
That was my problem with the show.
Right. You're going to do it by saying, "Here, taste this. This is really good."
Yeah. Exactly. We so related to that, riffing off on that a little bit, and some of the work that we've done in Detroit and in Flint, Michigan, and in San Jose, California, and in Louisville, Kentucky, just to kind of name some of those other pockets where there's a growing awareness and sort of fascination with local food and better food and more sustainable food and hip food, and yet there's this sort of like, what do we do to employ people, which is also really important in a lot of those cities, more everywhere else than in Louisville, but definitely also in Louisville. And the same kind of tension exists because urban agriculture has been sort of starting to drive some change, both for educating people about food and putting people to work and giving opportunities and beautifying communities and all these kinds of things. And sometimes there's this just assumption, particularly in places like Detroit and Flint, we have all this land, we can reclaim the land, we can grow food, it's going to taste great. And you get all the community members together and not all of them want to be growing that food, because actually they went to Detroit and Flint in the first place to get away from sharecropping. And there's this idea that it's sort of a revival of sharecropping is like an anathema to what the ideals are.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm also thinking about something you said about fast, convenient, plentiful, and cheap. And I'm sort of thinking, if Mitchell were here, I know exactly what he would say, but I'm going to put that on the table because he's not here. But I'm also thinking about like this financial piece of it, right? We were talking about this before the show. Like, what is really going to happen in the food paradigm and from the corporate perspective in order to incorporate taste and flavor more into the technology and the science and the processing of food, which we're never going to get away from, and it's just not even realistic to think so. What kind of communication needs to happen between the eaters and the makers to incorporate this thread of taste and flavor for change?
Well, you know, I agree. First of all, I just want to say I couldn't agree with you more that the corporations have to be part of the solution. And, you know, I think that they have to be part of changing the taste and the values, because if you look at who knows how to make people want things, mm-hmm. it's probably not the good food movement, and it's probably Kraft. You know, I mean, Kraft knows how to make you want to eat something, mm-hmm. and we should tap into that. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. But I think that you're seeing it start to happen already. There was this great or interesting article in the New York Times last week about Frito-Lay and how they are sort of creating a company within a company for snacks. And they basically have their high-end consumers and then what they call value consumers, which I thought was a nice euphemism. And, you know, the value consumers get Doritos and Cheetos, and the high-end consumers get fruit and nuts and
hummus,
you know,
I think.
Hummus and, you know, high-end pretzels and all this stuff. And, you know, I think that, on the one hand, I think that's really sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were a company trying to make money, I guess that's what I would do too.
Yep.
But what I think that could happen is to try to make those higher-end, healthier snacks cool.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to eat that, try to create that desire. And my bet is, although I don't know, that they're making almost as good a margin on those things as they are on Cheetos and Doritos. So maybe, you know, if they create the volume demand for that kind of thing, they could make more money. I mean, it's always going to be probably cheaper to make Doritos than it is to make hummus and celery sticks.
At least for a while. So with that thought, we're going to take a short break. I'd like everybody who's listening to think about what triggers taste for them, and we'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Great. Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Karen Karp, substituting for Mitchell Davis. This morning, my guest is Jane Black, food writer, Brooklyn-based, Washington Post, writing a book with her husband about the aftermath in Huntington, West Virginia, of how food cultures evolve after there has been a superstar effect. During the break, we were just talking about, before the break, we ended by talking about a sort of new bifurcation of marketing strategies by Frito-Lay of sort of normal snacks and value snacks. And we actually have a guest visitor with us today, a young woman named Pilar Bermudez, who is the daughter of a very good friend of mine and visiting us from Los Angeles doing an internship with the New York City Green Card Initiative. And she asked a really good question during the break that I'm going to ask you to ask to Jane and I and have us try to answer your question.
So earlier you had talked about like fast and like a bountiful and like just a lot of like fast food and how available fast food is and how it's not healthy. But my question that I had was for people who like the larger consumer of fast food and how much it is and like how cost efficient it mm-hmm. is. Some people, like, I understand that it's not healthy, but for some people that's like that's what they need because they have bigger families or they don't have enough money to afford healthy food, because like buying fruits and vegetables is more expensive and you don't get as much and it doesn't really fill you up either.
Right.
So like I was just wondering like how if we are going to like work towards a healthier America with more like fruits and vegetables, how we're going to make that available to people with low income and larger families, right, and for people who like work like maybe 2-3 jobs and don't have the time, right, to get anything else besides fast food?
It's a great question.
Well, you know, I would say that you know, it's a really good question, and it's a question I get a lot. I also think it speaks to how fabulous fast food marketers are at doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. Because I don't actually think going to McDonald's is that good a deal. I mean, McDonald's, contrary to conventional wisdom, doesn't target really poor people because nobody really wants poor people as their customers. I mean, you know, they don't have enough money. They target middle-class people. And my husband and I in Huntington cooked 3 meals a day, essentially, and we kept track of all of our grocery bills. And granted, we know how to cook, you know, so that's, mm-hmm, something. But, you know, our meals ended up costing $2.37 per meal, mm-hmm, over the course of a certain period of time, which is, yeah, there's the dollar meal, but you don't, you know, people who go get the dollar meal don't just go get one hamburger. You know, they get a couple things. Yeah. It's basically cheaper than fast food. Now, that means you need to know how to cook, and that means you need to eat leftovers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't want to eat leftovers. But I do think that, you know, there's this idea that it's a lot better value than it actually is. And I also think that, you know, this idea that you need to have these enormous portions because you don't have a lot of money, mm-hmm, is not true, because those calories don't really fill you up. So I think that one thing that, you know, fast food companies and food companies could do is work on portion sizes.
Yep.
You know, then you don't have to say to people, don't ever eat Cheez-Its, don't ever eat McDonald's, don't ever eat this. You just don't have to eat quite as much of it. And that's sort of a much more accessible message, mm-hmm, than you still have to start eating quinoa now from now on. Right. Nobody wants to hear that. I don't even want to eat quinoa for the rest of my life.
Right. Once a month, maybe. Yeah. But Pilar's question is very good, because it sort of cuts to the heart of, you know, one of the biggest social issues we have right now is obesity, and combined with a lot of people who can't afford a healthy grocery basket full of food and don't have the skills or the education or the time to cook the stuff. It's sort of like this perfect storm of agriculture, diet-related illnesses, hunger, and the economy, all kind of like a train, like these four trains, like heading into this intersection of calamity. So, you know, my perspective in our work, and the reason I like to have these conversations, including on this show when we're talking about taste, is we are literally about to have a train wreck in this country with all of these systems kind of, you know, collapsing on each other at once. And my hope and my thought is that the economic crisis that we're having is actually going to be able to sort of turn enough people from enough different perspectives, enough sectors around government sector, the business sector, the good food sector people, entrepreneurs, and consumers are kind of going to be able to sort of just like wake up, slow down, and sort of look at literally what's on their plate and say, what kind of responsibility do I have to change this? Now, but there's a whole issue of subsidies and benefits, and we're not going to have time to get into that on this show, related to food stamps and how people do get help to purchase food if they can't afford it. But since you brought up portion size, let's talk about soda.
All right. Let's talk about soda.
So here we are in the hotbed of municipal food policy. And as soon as you mentioned portion size, I couldn't help thinking about this new proposed legislation that's on the table here in New York City by Mayor Bloomberg to limit the size of a container of soda that can be served in restaurants and fast foods and concession stands, etc. Do we think that this can help this problem? Can that help us get back to broccoli?
Okay, so I could argue either side of this, uh-huh, just so you know, but the truth is that I was actually one of the people polled by Quinnipiac University recently, uh-huh, and I said, what do I think about this? And I decided, I think it's great. Uh-huh. First of all, I just think Bloomberg on food, I love the way he's just says to hell with it. I don't know if it's the best idea, but let's just do it. I think
a little more thought than that goes into it, but he has this boldness for sure.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And, you know, I think that, is it the ultimate solution? No. When these people came out of the woodwork saying, well, that's not going to solve the problem. Well, you know what? Limiting soda sizes is not going to solve the problem, but it might help. It's not the one answer. There is no one answer.
Right. Right.
And I think that, you know, there is a certain amount to, you know, if you have a 32-ounce soda, you drink a 32-ounce soda. If you have a 16-ounce, mm-hmm, soda, you drink a 16-ounce soda. And maybe some people will go and buy two and they'll still drink it. But most people will go and still get one and that's all they'll drink.
They'll
and
that think will, about the second one, right? Yeah. They'll think about the second one.
And it will cut it down, and it will become something that is acceptable to have a smaller drink. And it will become normalized, just like when, you know, they said, oh, we're going to stop having smoking in bars. And everyone said, well, that will never work. And then it did work. Right. And it became socially unacceptable, essentially, to be smoking in a bar. So that's what we want. We want it to be normal to have a smaller portion size.
Yeah. I'm now unhappy that I wasn't called by Quinnipiac, because I also have my opinion about it, and I've thought long and hard about this, because, you know, we work in the food industry, and of course they don't want their people that corporate executives say things like, where will it end? If you start here, where will it end? And other people, you know, think, including me, saying, well, you know, we are kind of all of us in a relationship around food that is different than the relationship was thought to be 50 years ago or 25 years ago or 10 years ago. And part of the difference of that relationship is these kind of big issues that are on the table about the lack of the healthfulness of our society, the lack of money to pay for healthcare, and who's responsible to whom. And so the analogy that I've kind of come up with about the soda proposal is, it's kind of like speed limits or seatbelts, right? You can break the speed limit and take the risk. You cannot wear a seatbelt and take the risk. Usually that would be a more risk to yourself. But if you break a speed limit and you get into an accident, you're actually impacting somebody besides yourself. And and from my perspective for the soda ban, I think that's what they're saying. They're basically saying, this isn't good for you, and it comes across as nanny state-ish kind of thing. But it's actually not good for society that people are consuming this many calories in this method. So we want everybody to slow down and be more thoughtful about it.
And I think this idea that, you know, where will we end up? I mean, let's talk about where we're going to start. You know, let's not worry about where we're going to end up right now. Uh-huh. And, you know, so I think that's one thing. I think it's just a scare tactic. Yeah. And, you know, soda isn't the ultimate evil. It isn't causing the obesity crisis, but it's a contributor.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's try to find one solution to one problem and then go to the next.
Yeah. So let's going back for a minute to what we were talking about Frito-Lay and their sort of, I'm kind of really, I feel like a bug in my bonnet about this sort of high-end snack market and this sort of regular snack market, because, you know, for a company that has marketed pretty well all across the board and perhaps does more marketing in low-income communities, you know, for them to sort of come out of the gate and say, okay, now we're going to do something special for rich people, there's something about them that really bothers me. And as you were describing it, I was thinking about a series of trainings we recently did. One of the many initiatives in New York City to get people to eat better is putting more supermarkets or upgrading supermarkets in communities where they've been, you know, not the best, you know, not probably not even as good as in Huntington, West Virginia. And we were very lucky to recently do some trainings related to the New York State program that is improving supermarkets in New York City. And we did some trainings in the South Bronx and some trainings in Coney Island. And my staff went in there with hummus and with carrots and with celery and with, you know, crackers and, you know, easy things to find in any supermarket. And there was no resistance by any of the kids that were with their parents trying this food. The parents were a little bit like, okay, this is strange, I'm not sure if I should eat it. But the kids were kind of lapping it up. And we have some incredible quotes, including one from a little boy who said, can I have this at my birthday party? You know, he was like dipping a cracker into hummus. And I'm thinking, so is Frito-Lay forgetting about these people? What's happening here?
I mean, you know, they may be forgetting about them and not thinking as broadly as you are. But, you know, as I say, I'm certainly not going to defend Frito-Lay. But I think one of the potential advantages to it is that, you know, we live in an aspirational society. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to be rich. We want to be the 1%, not the 99%. And if the 1% are eating hummus and crackers and celery sticks, maybe that gets to be cool. Maybe, you know, Cameron Diaz is eating it and everyone says, oh, yeah, I want to go eat that. So, look, I agree with you. I think I would be much more happy if Frito-Lay was trying to figure out a way to get it to everybody. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe.
Right.
I'm an optimist. Maybe it's a first step.
So we have about 1 minute left, and I just sort of want to say, so if you were to pick one big sector, either the corporate food sector or the USDA or local government, and if you were to say what one thing do you wish for them that they could do to shift forward to improving taste, what would that be?
Well, I would probably make my wish for the corporate food sector because I really believe that people who are involved in, you know, reforming food have set up this animosity between corporations and themselves. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that we need to work together. And I really believe that food marketers know how to market food.
Uh-huh.
So I would like to see people sitting down and talking about, you know, how can we build demand for in places like Huntington, in places like the Bronx,
right,
for these kinds of things so that they can, hell, get out there and sell more food.
That's great. And I'll put my bid in for what I wish for is that when government is creating restrictive policies, which, as you know, we both just agreed we kind of, or acknowledge we both kind of agree to, that when they're taking something away, they actually give something back. So I'm going to take away your soda cup. I'm going to give you a delicious peach. I think it needs to be. I think it needs to be both, or it to balance out for better taste. And I think that pretty much wraps us up for today. These half hours fly by so fast. I'd like to thank my guest Jane Black, food writer based in Brooklyn, writing a book with her husband about the aftermath in Huntington, West Virginia, and the future of food there. I'm Karen Karp from Karp Resources. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. 3時間も待っていたのよ私猫と一緒に
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.